All right. So, just a little bit again, review sort of where we were last week, the motivation, what we're going to be talking about, all that good stuff. This was the first slide last week, and you guys know how I like to repeat slides. At least this isn't what is a sacrament. So, so the point is for us to not just think about being saved, but to think about becoming holy, okay? Not just to think about sort of being defensive, but being offensive, to use the gifts God is giving us to become saints, okay? Everyone in here should want to become a great saint. There's nothing wrong with that. So the goal is to be made perfect, all right? And for a lot of us, it just becomes a matter of, well, I just want to avoid sin. That's great. That's the first step in the process, but only the first step. And so we want to move beyond that, okay? So we talked last week about putting on Christ, and so now we're going to spend the rest of the semester kind of getting comfortable in our new skin, okay? Part of which today, so last week we talked about sort of the knowledge of God, what he's, how he works in us, all right? That was, if we sort of encapsulate everything we talked about, it was that, all right? This week we're going to talk about what we do on our side of it. So how it works mechanically, if that makes sense. So we're going to talk a lot about how prayer works, not in the sense of like how it changes us, but how we actually go about it, right? How we do it in our body and in our soul. All right? So the goal then is self-knowledge, right? So there's always two directions, right? Knowledge of God leads to knowledge of self. Knowledge of self leads to knowledge of God, right? So this week we're going to talk about how to grow in self-knowledge. And here is St. Teresa of Avila. So as you guys are sort of picking things out for spiritual reading, sort of the five or six saints, I haven't really thought about who they are, but five or six saints, however they are, that I recommend are St. Teresa of Avila, St. John of the Cross, St. Therese, St. Francis de Sales, of course, St. Thomas Aquinas, and I think that would be my five, okay? And the number is on purpose, right? So we'll talk about at the end why I gave you five, because they're all going to come at it from different angles. So St. Teresa says, it's no small pity, and she causes no little shame, that through our own fault, we do not understand ourselves or know who we are. So through our own fault, we don't know who we are. We spend a lot of time trying to pretend to be something we're not, or trying to even just figure it out, figure out who we are. And so today we're going to talk about what we are, and then we'll talk about how to discern who we are. Right? Thus the title about psychology. So we're not going to be sort of talking about, this is more from like a Thomistic standpoint, okay? So psychology, the definition that St. Thomas would give is the study of the acts, powers, and habits of man. We must first analyze the acts of man before we can say anything about his powers, and we must first study his powers before we can say anything about his soul. So in other words, what St. Thomas does is says, okay, let's start with sort of ontologically, to use a big word that just basically means what the thing is, ontologically, what is man? And then, okay, how do we know that? Well, we look at the things that man can do, especially compared to other creatures. Yes?
Is this statement equating habits with soul?
Yes. So habits reside both in the body and in the soul. We'll talk about it at the end. Or not even at the end. We'll talk about it in just a little bit, how what that means, okay? So when he uses the word habits, he doesn't mean like the annoying like clicking of your tongue kind of thing. It means something that actually resides in your soul. It's like a habitual disposition that turns you towards something, okay? A virtue is a great example of a habit. Grace is a habit. So it's not the typical, and we'll talk more about this when we talk about virtue just a little bit. Okay, so the difference then between sort of what St. Thomas calls psychology, he would say first we sort of look at what human nature is before we would do something in like a contemporary clinical kind of practice approach. Okay, so which is the way it sort of should be, right? Because St. Thomas would say that, well, if you're going to a psychologist, for example, you would want to know what their definition of mental health is, right? If they're going to help restore mental health to you, you'd want to know what their definition of mental health actually is, right? Just as you would when you chose some other doctor in some other area, right? If someone says that, you know, having your heart only at 80% capacity is a healthy heart, you probably wouldn't want to choose them as your doctor, right? And so his point is, first, let's define what mental health is, and then we can talk about the ways in which we work. So it's not, we're not going to look at psychology in sort of the clinical setting. We're going to look at it more, take a step back and look at it in the philosophical sense, okay? All right, so first and most obvious slide of the day, just to understand what it means that we are body and soul, all right? And I want to sort of talk about this and tease this out a little bit. So here's what the Catechism says. Man, though made of body and soul, is a unity. Through his very bodily condition, he sums up in himself the elements of the material world. Through him, they are thus brought to their highest perfection and can raise their voice of praise freely given to the Creator. For this reason, man may not despise his bodily life. Rather, he is obliged to regard his body as good and to hold it in honor, since God has created it and will raise it up on the last day. This seems kind of obvious, right? We all sort of understand this, but we don't act like this. All right. Most of us get trapped in sort of a what's called dualism, where we look at the body and soul separately, as if they're not one thing. Okay, they obviously are sort of parts of us, but you are your body and you are your soul. And so, what's the implication of this? Right, going back to the definition that St. Thomas says, well, look at the axe. What kind of axe can a man make? Because he's body and soul. Say it again. He's able to do good and evil. Go even back a step further. So let's start. Let's just look at the implications of being both material and spiritual. Well, let's back up. What does it mean to be a spirit? Yes. Okay, to know and to love. So to have an intellect and a will. All right? So that's what it means to be a spirit. To be able to know and to love. So man, as a bodily organism, then can do purely bodily acts, right? We're all doing them right now. We're all breathing. Right? Angels don't breathe. God doesn't breathe. But animals breathe. Right? So he's capable of doing things on an animal level. He's also capable of doing things on a spiritual level, like knowing abstract things. You know, think about it, some kind of abstract science, right? Think of calculus or something like that, right? Only man can do calculus. Only the angels can do calculus, right? Which ought to sort of, when you're struggling with your calculus, ask your guardian angel for help. But there's a mixture of those two things, and that's where we sort of live most of our lives. This sort of mixture of bodily and spiritual acts. Somebody give me an example.
Pray.
Can angels pray?
Yeah.
Okay. Ryan, it's not a bad answer, though, because we pray differently than the angels do.
You can, like, pray in certain ways with your body.
Okay. What else? Yes.
Give someone a hug.
Okay. So, how is that a spiritual act?
It's conveying some sort of intent about, like, your love or care.
Okay, this isn't meant to be like a tough question, by the way. Just think about everything we talked about last semester about what a thing is. Sure. No, the whole semester we talked about it. That's a good guess, though. So the wow, I totally lost track of what you're talking about. So our bodily acts are what? They are. Do I really need to put up the, like,
spiritual?
Material. They're signs, right? Signs pointing to what?
What our soul is doing.
Yes, right. So how do we know what someone is thinking about us? How they act towards us, right? Like, if I walk in the room and everyone's shoulders slump, I can kind of go, I know what everyone thinks about me. Right? So this is sort of mixture, and that's where everything sort of plays out, especially what we're going to talk about with prayer, right? Because you think there's this, you know, it's called the spiritual life, and it's just about my soul. But it's not, right? We talked last week about the body being the temple of the Holy Spirit, and it is in the body that you will all become saints, please God. In the body, and through your bodily acts. Right? So this idea of being a composite creature is really important. All right? So there's the unity of the body and soul is what the Catechism talks about. Unity of soul and body is so profound that one has to consider the soul to be the form of the body. That it is because of its spiritual soul that the body made of matter becomes a living human body. Spirit and matter in man are not two natures united, but rather their union forms a single nature. All right, let's unpack this for just a second, because hopefully it'll help you guys get unshy. I don't know why you guys are so shy today. So, does anyone remember what it means for the soul to be the form of the body? What makes the human body a human body?
Organs.
Okay.
Certain number of chromosomes in the DNA.
Okay.
Do you mean aside from animals or like
just whatever, however you want to answer, Keaton, go for it.
I mean, like the ability to think.
Okay. Alright, so that is a uniquely human act, right? So a cadaver still has all the chromosomes?
Yes.
Still has all the organs, assuming? Okay.
Image and likeness.
Okay, so what is it that makes it a human body?
The soul animates the body.
The soul, right? Yes. Because you take the soul out of it, it ceases to be a human body, right? So that's all, when you hear this idea of the soul being the form of the body, it's what makes the body what it is. Right? The presence of a spiritual soul is what makes the human body be what it is. All right? Does that make sense?
Why is it not the other way around? Like the body is the form of the soul, like a reflection of your soul.
Yeah, that's a great question, because what you're thinking about is you're overly materializing the soul. As if the soul, and this is a mistake a lot of people make, in fact, Plato made it too. He thought that the soul just sort of is a cup to hold, I mean, the body is just this cup that holds the soul. Right? And then eventually you got to shed it off and be done with it. But when you talk about form, with a form of something, don't think in terms of like a, one of those templates that makes something like it is, like you're tracing something or something. Think of it in terms of how it makes that thing what it is. So that body becomes a part of human nature. Does everyone understand what Sharpie said? So our goal is not to be, that's the point of the other slide, but our goal is not to be free of the body, okay? In fact, we will get these same exact bodies back, right? But think about that for just a second, and it will help make it a little clearer. So I don't have the same body as when I was born, right? The skin cells have slopped off, totally different matter. So what is it that makes this body my body?
Soul.
The presence of the soul. Okay, that's the idea. All right. And so, so then the reason why this is sort of important to just understand is that this, yes?
Beth, can you just clarify a little bit when you say, like, we'll get this exact body back, acknowledge that it's going to be different matter?
Different, but it does the matter... Does the matter matter? Sorry. Does the matter matter?
So, like that's, can we just get back new matter that we make it our own body because it'll be our soul?
Yes. The soul takes to itself your body. So the soul makes the body what it is.
Does that make teleportation a thing that can happen?
teleportation.
Like Star Trek?
That's a great... I had never thought of that.
Like, apart all the atoms and put them back together from other atoms in the same form?
Well, how do you separate the body from the soul and then put the soul back in the body?
Kill the person.
Yeah. Right. So I would say no if I had to say that.
It seems kind of meaningless to say it's the exact same body because, like, it has different characteristics. In fact, it's no longer temporal. If it's just the fact that our soul is tied to it, that just means it's our body. Like, it just seems meaningless to say.
Exactly. Well, did Jesus get back the same body?
Yes.
It was no longer temporal, though.
This is the point of him. This is a good discussion. The point of him showing his wounds, right? Because what were they going to? They were going to say to him. They were going to like, yeah, I don't know who you are, but that's not that same guy, right? So it's the same body, but it has new powers and new capacities and new. It's important because the reason why this is important, and this is why you see things like in saints, non-corrupt saints,
yeah.
Right? At the resurrection of the body, what will they get? Literally, all that same matter back, right? They were so holy that their bodies didn't decay. So, in some sense, you're right. It's not the same. It's not the same in that that it's exactly the same matter or has the same powers, but we will all look the same as we do now in some way, right? We'll be glorified. We will. But we'll still look the same. Yes?
The cool thing is that even now, like, I think it's something like in 7 years or something, every molecule you have in your body now won't be there anymore. So, like...
Unless there's teleportation, then it's just falling apart, right?
But, I mean, like, you shed skin cells all the time. Your body's constantly recycling, so, like, even who you are now and who you were 10 years ago, completely different physically, but you're still you.
Yeah, the principle of unity obviously is your soul, right? That, I think, is the point. Joseph, yes?
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's too scientific, but doesn't it violate the conservation of mass?
In what way?
Listen, there is only a definite mass in the universe, and there are, like, people coming in. Like, there are millions of people who have been born and who have died. So there is definite mass, so...
Yeah, but I don't know that I can answer this definitively, but... Isn't there enough matter in the universe for that to be reconciled?
Yeah.
I would think probably. I mean, I don't know. I could be wrong. But
even on Earth, like, we've only got, I think there's more people alive today than have ever died still, like, because the population exploded to 7 billion within the past 50 years, and before that it was mostly under a billion for, and, like, even smaller. It might be a little bit. It's not much more if it's more than it died, like, because this amount of people is relatively recent.
Yeah, and this is a total rabbit hole if we keep talking about this, but I mean, it doesn't necessarily have to be the same amount of matter, all that, right? I mean, it can be different.
I mean, I was like reading this. I mean, in some blog post or somewhere where somebody was asking this question, like, imagine a hypothetical situation where you went into the forest and some wild animal ate you. And your body becomes part of them. So when you resurrect, whose body will you get?
Yeah. And the answer to that question is it doesn't matter, right? It doesn't matter what you don't physically need to have the same exact, you know, carbon atoms making up your body because you don't have the same carbon atoms you had, you know, 4 days ago. Whatever. Okay. You mean the effect of time? Probably not.
Okay.
Is there a quick, like, sort of question? I don't want to get us too...
Right, so the soul's what animates the body, and the body obviously changes in the natural realm with the passage of time. So because there is no passage of time in the supernatural realm, does that mean that's why our bodies don't age?
No, I would say that our bodies don't age because it's a supernatural gift. There is still something like time, even, you know, like the saints experience something like time in heaven. The angels experience something like time in heaven. It's not exactly the same as we experience it. It's not measured in the same way. It doesn't, you know, time is just a measure of change, right? And so things do, you change in heaven, right? You come to know new things. You you know, angels change.
Thomas Aquinas specifically said angels don't change.
Well, they change in that they don't change in their knowledge, but they can change in their capacity to love, for example. Right? Because they can't love a new creature come into being. They can't love them before they're in being. So even they are somehow, and they can't know free will acts and things like that.
Okay. I mean, I just know, like, they share in the knowledge of God, and God's knowledge is...
But he doesn't give it to... Your guardian angel doesn't know what you're going to do, for example. So that in some ways they change because they learn that you did something. That's why there's an effect of time even on angels. If not, then again, this is a total rabbit hole, so we probably should cut it off. But if not, then you'd have to say they were eternal and had no beginning, right?
Separate question.
Good.
You might have mentioned this before. Can the body have, like, changed the soul? Like, something about the way you are changes something physically, changes something in your soul?
I think you'd be careful to say, like a physical change in the soul, but what your body does has an effect on your soul. It wouldn't be like a physical change, but, I mean, think about it, like, what is sin or vice, or it changes your soul, right? This is where the idea of habits and dispositions matter. Which we'll talk about in a second. Real quick, and hopefully to get us back a little bit on track. So you'll see a lot of, in Scripture, you'll see the idea of the soul versus your spirit. This is just to sort of to make the distinction that the human soul isn't like the soul of a plant or the soul of an animal. Okay, so every living thing has a soul. Soul is just the thing that animates a living creature, something that gives it life. The human soul is called a spirit or a soul because not only does it animate the body, but it also has a spiritual capacity and spiritual power. Okay, so you'll see, especially St. Paul talks a lot about it. He'll call it his spirit or he'll call it his soul. And they're sort of synonymous, but not exactly. All right, but it's not something to sort of be hung up on. All right, so let's sort of dive into this now. All right, so St. Thomas said to look at the what the person can do, and then you'll discover that by looking at those things that that he has certain powers attached to them, okay? So the fact that we can do things with abstract knowledge, the fact that we can create art, the fact that we can communicate, right? It says that, okay, man must have some sort of spiritual capacities, an intellect and a will. But the fact that we feel anger and we feel joy and we feel sadness must mean that we also have a capacity to have what are called emotions or passions. All right, so how we were made, so the intellect is the highest sort of power that man has. Okay. And the intellect feeds on the truth. And the will does the good, feeds on the good, and the passions or the emotions are meant to help us to do the good with a bodily sort of intensity. Okay? Yes.
Is this the same like personal good you were talking about last time?
Yes. I mean, don't get too hung up on it. So the will, remember we talked last week, I'm glad you brought it up, but the will is sort of ordered to the good, and then we have free will towards specific goods, right? Means to that one end. So yes, that's what I'm talking about. So, and this is where, Keegan, to answer your question, this is where the body begins to change the soul. Okay? So, when you do the good and the body participates in it, so in other words, you do it with a little bit of passion, for example, right? That makes your will stronger. Okay. And then when you do it again, and maybe you do it a little more bodily intensity, the will gets stronger and stronger and stronger. So that's what's called a habit, right? And it changes your disposition so that now the good becomes easy. It becomes joyful. There's pleasure in it, okay? And it unfortunately goes the other way too, right? Where if you do something that is contrary to the good and you begin to do it more and more bodily intensity, right? It begins to change your soul. All right, so this is how it's meant to be, okay? Where the passions are controlled by the will. So in other words, when Christ goes into, this will be a good example for us. So when Christ goes into the, clear the temple, right? He's angry. But why isn't that sinful? Okay, what does that mean? What does righteous anger mean? Yes. Right, does everyone hear what Nicole said? It was so in other words, he didn't go in there and just suddenly feel anger. He went in there and looked with his intellect and said, oh, my father's house is being defaced. And then he willed to feel anger. Okay, that was how we were made. That was how it was supposed to be. Okay, we were supposed to... all of our feelings were supposed to follow our will, okay? But then when we fall, so what happens is, well, our intellect gets darkened, so we don't know the truth as easily. Our will is weakened, and our passions begin to sort of run amok, okay? And so now they insert themselves between the intellect and the will. And so the will doesn't know quite how to act, okay? Whether the intellect is saying, do this, or the passions are saying, do this. All right, and we'll talk more about this in just a second, and it'll make more sense. But just to understand that sort of perfect, where the powers line up like that, that was by design, and then with the fall, it's no longer that way. Yes?
Is this to say that our passions should never influence our thinking or our intellect? Like, if we feel compassion, that kind of thing?
Can you hold that question? Because it's a perfect question for when we get to it. So, just to sort of talk about this for just a second. So, are we stuck like this?
No.
What can you do?
Practice control.
All right. So, practice controlling your passions. What is that called? So, I just repress them? Is that what it is? I feel anger and I just shove it down. Is that the solution to this? Huh?
Start thinking really hard.
Okay. Is that enough though?
It's not, because if you do it on your own, it's gonna explode. Like, you can't. The whole point of this is, like, you on your own are kind of stuck.
Okay.
Jesus is the secret sauce to help get things back in order. Like, when you're especially talking about chastity, it comes up a lot where it says, you know, don't just ignore the fact that you have some temptation or something. Pray about it, because you cannot change it on your own. You need help. You need grace. And it starts reorienting stuff. And the praying is the act of the will that you provide, but everything else...
Is grace the only way? I mean, certainly that is true.
I think prayer is not the only way to go about doing it. Like mortification asceticism can help through the process, and then also like focusing on this decision in a smaller scale.
Okay, what is it called? Yeah, you're right. So what is it called when I push the passions back under the will? Does anyone know what that thing is called?
Self-control.
Well, it's called self-control, but it's also called a virtue. Right? It doesn't necessarily just have to be... okay, so what a virtue does... It's the habit of controlling your passions and directing them towards the end they were made for. Okay? All right. So we'll come back to that in a second, and then we'll also get to Kevin's question when we get to them. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about the powers themselves, and we'll see. In each one of these, we'll sort of take a little diversion toward and apply it to our prayer life. Okay? All right. So the intellect... Here's what St. Thomas says. Intelligent beings are distinguished from non-intelligent beings in that the latter possess only their own form, whereas the intelligent being is naturally adapted to have also the form of some other thing. The idea of the thing known is in the knower. All right, that should be pretty self-explanatory, right? Seriously? All right, let's unpack it, okay? All right, so we all agree that there's something unique about the way that human beings know things, right? What is unique about the way human beings know things? How are we different from the animals?
Being able to imagine.
We have moral agency.
Okay. moral agency, being able to imagine, being able to imagine, sort of.
I mean, the idea that you can think about a concept that's not in front of you. That's
concept, that's key, right? So what Jean-Claude said is, so an animal can only think about specific things, okay? Only think about material things, the thing right in front of it. It can't think of abstract concepts. All right, so that's what St. Thomas means when he starts using the word form, right? Remember I said earlier about form being, think about it in terms of the nature of something. So when we know something, that thing becomes a part of us. Okay? Think about that for just a second. All right? When I say car to you, can any of you think of a car without seeing an image of some car?
Yes.
Really?
Wait.
Dude, you're on your own level then, man. Come here.
I thought you were asking, can you see a car without a car being, like, physically...
No. Can you think about a car without a car being present? So that's what he means by the thing known as in the knower. So when I say car, all of you, or maybe I should do the opposite, say don't think about a car. And then immediately car... you have this image of your car, right? Does that car that you are thinking about actually exist?
No.
Maybe.
No. I'm thinking one of those Transformer cars.
Probably more detail than I needed, but sure. no, it doesn't exist out... I mean, you may be thinking of a specific car, and that's fine. But even that, the existence of that thing is only in your mind, okay? That's what he means by the thing known as in the knower. That's all he just says. Okay, and we as human beings have the capacity to do that with everything. We can know all things in creation. All right? Does that make sense? So this idea of the thing known is in the knower.
Do you think you say all things known in creation, is that just material things or material and spiritual?
Yeah, it would be spiritual as well. All things... well, yeah, I'll answer that question. We cannot have full knowledge.
Anything.
We have the capacity to, but we don't ever achieve it. So here is where I sort of want to go with this, though. So immediately we think about what's the purpose of, if we think about the thing known is in the knower, what is the purpose of knowledge? Go ahead.
To lead us to God.
You just took like the I mean, yes. But the purpose of knowledge is union, right? If the thing known is in the knower, then the purpose of knowledge is union. So here's where I'm going with this, so we don't have to go any more philosophically. What about God? If I say the word God to you, do all of you, what pops into your mind?
Still get the fuzzy gray beard.
What do you see?
Get rid of that.
Yeah, I think most people do. How many people don't get the fuzzy gray beard?
Or well, sometimes just like a cloud.
Yeah. Okay. But there's an image there, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Is that what God looks like? Or just an image?
Two of the persons of God don't have physical form.
All right, so what becomes the problem, right? If the thing known is in the knower, so union happens, how do we know God? Yeah, how do we know him, though?
He has to reveal to us.
Why? Now, to Sharvey's point, you hold the answer. So Sharvey said, Vatican I said that we can know the existence of God, right? So we can know God as a concept. But here's my question. How do we know God as a person in the state we're in right now? Yes?
Through the soul.
Through the soul, absolutely. But we just sort of said, okay, well, when I say that, there's an image that comes to mind that really you can't fit an image to God, right? I mean, you could certainly, through the incarnation, you could, yes.
God's acts.
All right, so you can know that, but Can I know him personally or just know something about him through his acts? Yes?
Like a previous time when you talked about, I guess right there, the thing that is known as infidel, where we talked a little bit last week about how God is kind of within us.
Not kind of.
Is within us.
Yeah, be firmer, because you're right on you're right on it.
And so, since God is within us, that's how we can know what is in
the infidel. Okay, did everyone sort of get that? Because that's really important. The thing known is in the knower. God, this is why the indwelling of the Holy Spirit is really important for us to grasp. Right? The thing known, God, is in us, is in the knower. Right?
So then the thing that is in the knower is known?
Yes. Okay? But here's the problem. How do we know him? I said it's not just by concepts, right? How do we know him?
Personal revelation.
Say it again?
Personal revelation.
It could be by a personal revelation, sure. Or how else? How does the ordinary person know God? Go ahead, Kevin.
Study scripture.
Okay, so that would fall along the lines of revelation. Think more of, again, think in terms of something that is interior to us. Think like a habit or a virtue.
You have an innate sense of what is just and what is good.
That would be God as a concept, right? And I'm doing this to you guys very deliberately because I want us to move away from God as an idea, which is good, to God as a person. Okay, this is why I'm really dragging you guys through this.
Is it like through communication?
Okay, what communication of what? You're right, but communication of what?
Like you with like another being that you're aware of within yourself?
Yeah, I think that maybe too abstract. Go ahead, Connor.
Faith.
Say that again, Connor.
Faith.
Faith. What is faith? What is faith? What is the virtue of faith? This is why, again, this is so important.
Believing in things that you don't see?
That is not faith per se. What is the virtue of faith? Go ahead, Connor, you already got it, so go ahead, keep going.
Is it the ability to, I guess, comprehend things that are beyond reason?
That would be a huge part of it, but don't say things. Right? Remember what I want us to move towards. Go ahead, Ken.
Is the faculty by which we know God?
Yeah, know God personally. It is God's share of his knowledge of himself with us. It's the habit of thinking like God about God. So faith is not sort of like, I believe in God. Yeah, there's some faith there, but St. John says the devils do that too. Right? It's not an assent to a bunch of beliefs in the creed. That's good. That's the content of faith. But the act of faith itself is putting on Christ completely and thinking the way God thinks about himself. So God shares knowledge of himself with us. Okay? Yes?
Does he share the knowledge equally with everyone, or it differs from person to person?
No, it varies because it's a virtue, and the strength of virtues vary from person to person. It changes, right? It's not just my knowledge of God in and of himself is not the same as it will be tomorrow or the next day, or hopefully.
So,
go ahead.
So, charismatic gift of faith. Would be like a supernatural, over achievement of the virtue of knowing, thinking of God's happening.
Yeah, describe what you mean by a charismatic gift of faith. What do you mean by that?
Classically defined charismatic gift of faith.
Yeah, I think so sometimes that's a little dicey because that's really, that's really more like a charismatic gift of faith is more like hope. And that it keeps you binding to. So I would say it's an abundance of hope, not necessarily abundance of faith. Does that make sense?
Yeah. What does it mean to think like God?
To think like God? Well, it's not just to think like God. There is, that's part of it, but it's to think like God about himself. So in other words, know things about that God knows, that only God knows about himself. Well, you think about, like, here's a good example. It's hard for me to say this because I'm not there at this part, but think about all the sort of the saints who have had, who've got to the highest levels of prayer, like St. Thomas, right? St. Thomas is a great example. Does everyone know the story at the end of St. Thomas' life? Where he is praying in front of the Blessed Sacrament, and one of his brother friars walks by and hears him talking to somebody. And he walks into the chapel and he's talking to Jesus in the Eucharist, and he can hear Jesus' voice, the brother can. And he says, "Thomas, you've written well of me, what do you want?" And he says, "Only you, Lord, only you." And then the next day, he stops writing. And they ask him, like, "Why'd you stop writing?" And he said, "Because of what I have seen, everything I've written is just straw." Right? Everything St. Thomas Aquinas wrote was straw compared to this revelation of God. Right? So what that's the culmination of it. But it is then the content of faith, right? Knowing things about God that starts with the creed and then going deeper to know things very specifically about God, right? And to know that he's trustworthy, to know that, you know, in the midst of things, this is where it becomes a total and complete act of faith, right?
How's that different from, like, personal revelation? Like God has to reveal that to you. You can't just innately...
Well, but it's a little bit of both, right? I mean, unless you have, like, an experience like St. Thomas... It's not like Moses on the mountain kind of revelation, but it is like, I mean, we've all sort of experienced this where we, even in prayer, where we're just like, we just have an aha moment where everything, just these clouds just clear. That's what it is, right? Where you just suddenly, and it gets simpler rather than more complicated, right? So the smarter you are, the more you can encapsulate big ideas into a single concept, right? Where you can tie everything together. And so your idea of God gets simpler and simpler, if that makes sense. Meaning in the sense that it gets less, has less parts to it, okay? So that's sort of what I mean. It's hard to explain as far as like content, because back to Joseph's point about it's different in every person. Like, God is revealing himself in different ways to every person. So yeah, you start with the creed, but you may, like, for example, you go, "I believe in God, the Father Almighty." And suddenly, God pulls you in at that moment. And he wants to show you how he's both Father and Almighty. And you have this great understanding, that's enlightenment that's given you, and keeps going deeper and deeper and deeper. Always leading you, so it's not an intellectual exercise, but always leading you to greater acts of love for God. Right? So you it gives you more reasons to love God. Right? Which is... you know, sort of theology on your knees, when you begin to know things about God that then give you more reasons to love the person. Okay. Does that help?
Yeah, I think my definition of personal love is wrong.
Keegan, were you going to ask me?
Similar questions.
Okay. All right. So let's talk a little bit about then just how we come to know things. All right. So St. Thomas says nothing is in the intellect which was not first in the senses. All right, so this is the body and soul thing. All right, this is us. How do we, as human beings, come to know things? In and through our body, okay? And some of you should automatically go, "Well, wait a second, hold on a second. I know plenty of things that I haven't experienced or seen." Okay? And this is why we have to be careful about limiting senses to our five senses, okay? So we're going to go through this real quick. I don't want to get really, really, really hung up on this. And sorry, I realize on the screen the coloring is not great. So the outside of the box is thing, okay? So this is the something we come in contact in the external world, all right? So it works on our five senses, okay? So we can hear, see, taste, touch, all that data is brought together in what's called the common sense, okay? And then the common sense then feeds it to our imagination and our memory, and it develops what's called a phantasm, okay? Again, don't get too hung up on this because you'll see why it's important in just a second. And then So this phantasm, this image formed by the imagination, is then what's given to the intellect to work on. All right, so we go from sort of pink to blue. It's hard to tell if it's even blue over there. So pink on the left side, blue on the right. Now we're into the intellect, okay? And so the intellect abstracts. So I've given an image of a chair, for example. And the intellect abstracts that from that image the nature of a chair. All right? And then we form an idea, okay? And then we do sort of the acts of the mind understanding. Okay, and that's just a sort of a simple way to look at it. But let me talk about, again, don't get too hung up on this, just understanding first that everything sort of comes in our sense, from our senses into our intellect, okay? Or vice, even when we try to think with our intellect, we go back. Remember I said earlier about when I said God, an image went into your, came into your mind, into your imagination. That's what it means, that it was in your... Now, if I tell you a whole bunch of things about God, you'll pull up memory. What does God mean? So you'll pull up the memory of God, fit it with the imagination, feed the intellect back, and that's how you think. It's sort of back and forth between your body and your soul. Okay, this is why when you're asleep, you can't think. Why this matters? Okay, so let's talk about the memory and imagination. Okay. So memory is an internal sense whereby an image is recalled and serves as a medium of intentional existence for an object no longer present to the observer. Okay. Again, this is sort of what we already know intuitively, that we have, materially speaking, we have our memory, which can pull up sort of images of things in our past, right? Of things that have happened in our past. And then we have our imagination, which is, by the way, the highest sort of material power that we have. So animals have memory, and they have something like imagination, although in our case, imagination can be creative. Theirs it can't. So I could say something like a unicorn to you, and the thing doesn't actually exist, but you're still able to imagine it. Yes?
I've heard this described in some ways, like someone will say, like, nothing is ever completely original, and like... When I think about imagination, like, one of the things that I haven't been able to disprove, at least, is the fact that you can imagine things you haven't seen, but you can't imagine something completely original. Like, a unicorn is possible to imagine because you know what a horse looks like and you know what a horn looks like. But try to think of a color that you've never seen, and you just can't.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so, I mean, there's still limits.
Well, because where does the imagination get its images from?
The memory. Like, it's still got to build up.
Not just the memory. It gets it from... It can go out, outward in, and inward out.
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah. So it has to somehow smash together memories. Like I have to, like, if someone told me what a unicorn was, I would somehow smash together the memory of a horse with a horn or something. But the part about it being original, and again, not to get stuck in this rabbit hole because I want to get it back to its prayer, but you can imagine things that. In a creative way that doesn't, something that has never existed before, because you could think of something. The image doesn't matter, though. You know what I mean? Like, if that makes sense. Just because that's the point with God, right? The concept of God, your image doesn't match it, but that's okay. It goes with the concept. All right, does that make sense? Okay, so there's two things to take away from this real quick, all right? Again, not to get really hung up on this. So, these are material senses, okay? Things that are in our body, all right? Which part of our body can, or which parts of us, if any, can angels and demons affect? Can let's just go, we'll go from the guardian angel standpoint first. So can my guardian angel, without my permission, do anything to me?
Say no, because don't you have to ask it or give it permission to do so?
Okay, that's a bad example. Let's go from the other way. Let's go from the demons, because a guardian angel not necessarily, right? I can stick with the angel,
yeah.
Right? Because they intervene at times when you didn't ask them to.
Mm-hmm. Fall asleep while driving.
Yeah. So Jean-Claude, say what you said again, but don't say the part about the intellect.
Okay. They can affect your, what you perceive and sense. And that can include what you think to a degree, because that's part of what you, are experienced. Thoughts can be injected into your mind.
Okay. Anyone want to take a guess? So what he said is more or less correct. How do they inject thoughts into your mind?
By influencing your perception of the things you're sensing?
It could be by affecting your perception. Right, so what does that mean? That they've affected your senses somehow, right? But they can... What's the raw material of our thoughts? Memory and... And imagination, right? If then angels can materially work on our material faculty, work on our memory and our imagination, okay? And then they don't, not necessarily that I would, if this thing pops up in my memory, that I'll go that line of thought, but they probably know me well enough to throw a sort of an image up there in order to get me thinking in a certain direction, okay? Now, if a guardian angel can do it, who else can do it? Demons, right? So demons can pull up pieces of your memory, images you've seen. And if you stop for just a second, you've all experienced this. This is not extraordinary. This is ordinary. This is the ordinary way in which they tempt you. Okay? The ordinary way is they take images, they take memories, throw them before your mind, and get you thinking about something. Okay? And that's one of the ways that when you hear about sort of like demons whispering in your ear, kind of, that's one of the ways they can affect us. So how do we guard our memory and our imagination? Yes?
I have a quick question. Does that mean that the more horror movies I've seen regarding demons, that make me more susceptible for them to conjure up memories of those images kind of thing?
No. I mean, maybe not, right? I don't want to... It's hard for me to say, I don't want to answer any of those questions, definitively yes, because I don't want us all freaked out about what they can and cannot do, but I also want us to be able to sort of protect ourselves and understand what their power to do is. What they will do is a totally different question. So, one of the ways that we obviously protect our memory and imagination is to guard it, right? So, what we see, what we watch, matters. What we think about, when we let our imagination run wild. This is why all the saints say, okay, mortify your imagination. If you start going off in dreamland, stop. Because you have to learn the ability to mortify your imagination. Okay? So one of the ways to guard against it is when you're in the habit of when images pop up, you don't necessarily always pay attention to them. Right? But that's really, really hard, right? We'll talk more about that part of it when we talk about demons. What I want to talk about now is, where do most of our distractions in prayer come from? Guess.
Stomach
could be one of them, that's true. Where, stomach, bathroom, we'll just push those off for right now. Well, when I'm sitting there praying, what stops me from praying, usually? How do I get off in another, suddenly I'm like, oh, wait a second, I was praying a minute ago.
I always end up thinking about something I'm worried about.
Yeah. Why does that happen? Sort of, but it's because we don't know how to govern our memory and our imagination, especially our imagination. Yes?
I think one thing is it really helps to be looking at the cross or something like that, because you're filling your mind, or before the Blessed Sacrament, you're filling your mind with something that is totally 100% awesome and good. And so sometimes even just closing my eyes is taking down the wrong track, because now I've just taken that out of my mind, and so I've opened the door.
So you just basically made the entire argument of what we're trying to say here. But why does the cross work? Because it's an image, right? Why do we keep images? But why do we have images? Why, as Catholics, are we so stuck on images? Why do I pray much better in front of a monstrance than in a blank room by myself? Yeah, because we have an image, right? We're not dependent upon ourselves for the image. We're not pulling up images from before. No one, when that image remains in front of me, this is, again, why the body really matters, right? But there's other parts of it, too, why we're so easily distracted a lot of times, especially for us now, like the amount of sort of visual stimulus that we get, like the amount of like binge watching on Netflix. I'm not saying like don't watch TV or whatever. But what happens is when we do this, we lose the ability to govern our imagination. All right. This is one of the sort of the dangers of like too much TV and movies, is that what happens? Well, when we watch TV, what happens? All these images are coming at us really fast, right? And that's not the, we're not really made for that, right? So we're, when suddenly we're like, I have all these images, how can I possibly interpret them? Because right? That's what our intellect wants to do. Wants every image it gets, it wants to abstract something from it, right? And the way that most movies work, especially now, they're very kind and they put the interpretation with them, right? So you don't have to do the hard work of figuring out, right? Like, you know, the happy gay guy, right? Oh, then gay must be happy, right? Or any of those things that sort of built-in messages with the movie or whatever you're watching, right? So not surprisingly, when we go and we sort of shut ourselves down for prayer, we don't have control of our imagination because we're used to it being fed with an interpretation, okay? Now, what am I saying? I'm not saying don't watch any TV, but I probably am saying that don't watch, like, you know, 4 hours of Netflix without taking a break. Don't watch, you pause it and digest what you just saw. All right? I mean, it seems like really, like, simple, but it, watching your prayer life improves when you learn how to govern your imagination a little bit. When you learn how to mortify your imagination, you're like, suddenly your focus in prayer is so much better. So that's where most of our distractions come from, okay? Kevin sort of stole my thunder about posture. Go ahead, steal my thunder again.
So you're not saying, like, don't have a brainstorming sesh when you're trying to do engineering, right?
No, that's a good thing. That's focused, okay. Right? Okay. I mean, that's what you're trying to do. No. If you've taken what I've said and think it, like, just be mindless and somehow more spiritual, that's not what I mean at all. I just mean keep it directed. Again, what the problem with our imaginations when you can't govern them is not, I mean, you're going to use them. That's what they're there for. I mean, you can't not use them. The point is to use them for something good rather than flitting all about. Okay, does that make sense? So, yeah, I mean, focus, you know, focus use of your imagination. That's what it was meant for.
And
yes?
I think that would even help with helping to control it, because in brainstorming, you normally, like, you get some bad ideas, but you're taking the time and then you're going, all right, this is, you're sorting through the distractions.
Yeah, I mean, study is one of the best ways to learn how to govern your imagination. Like, there's a virtue called studiosity, where it's focused study rather than curiosity is the vice. Curiosity is just letting us sort of, just the pleasure of knowledge itself, just kind of, you know, surfing the internet is a great example of curiosity, where we're just looking for stuff because it'd be nice to know different things and not really for a purpose. But studiosity is one of the ways we learn to control our imagination. All right, so this sort of summarizes what Kevin said about the importance of posture. All right, from C.S. Lewis, from the Screwtape Letters, he says, you know, one of the ways we trick them is, at the very least, they can be persuaded that the bodily position makes no difference to their prayers. All right, so this is not just praying in front of a crucifix, but this is the way we pray, our bodily posture when we pray matters. But they constantly forget, well, you must always remember that they are animals and that whatever their bodies do affect their souls. So kneeling down, certain times to pray, good idea. Why? Why does it? Why should we kneel down?
Submission.
Say it again.
Submission.
It's a sign of, when I use the word sign very deliberately, a sign of submission. When I submit my body like that, what does my soul do? Submits, right? This, by the way, this is why the rosary is one of the most perfect prayers, right? Think about it. It engages the entire person, from the fingers to moving the beads to the meditation to the vocal prayer, all that. That's the power of the rosary. It's a very human way to pray. Somebody else going to say something to me?
I was going to say it's also just since you don't do many other things in that posture, it helps keep you focused because your body begins to associate those two things.
Yeah, the association is really important. Like, how often do you get down on your knees? How often do you bow? How often are you in supplication with, you know, face down? Those kinds of things. So there is, if you do a Google search on, St. Dominic was really big on, he's the founder of the Dominicans, of teaching the friars different positions to pray in, with each one having a sort of a name to it. So if you Google, I think it's St. Dominic, the nine prayer postures, he has like meditations on the nine different ways that he said to pray. And it sort of helps you to begin to pray in your body and understand what that really means. Because you can't just be spiritual without being bodily. Okay. Kevin, you going to say something?
As we sometimes, like I feel like, yeah, like, I get the temptation to sort of, like, be comfortable when I pray, and that's kind of like you're losing a lot there, you know, because it's like an example of kind of giving in to...
Yeah, you don't want to be, like, totally uncomfortable that it distracts you, but a certain amount of discomfort, again, is a reminder that, oh, I'm in the presence of God is way, way above me, right? And trust me, I've been trying for years to do my examination of conscience laying in the bed, and it just doesn't work. So let me just drop some wisdom on you. So wait till the last minute and then go, I'll just lay down and do it. It doesn't work. I think laying down is a bad posture for sorrow for my sins. All right, so let's move to the will.
It does give you more for that next
day, though. Here's that, I guess. Thanks, I had never really looked at it that way, but I feel much better. All right.
I mean, I feel horrible about it. So I was trying to make a joke.
So the will. All right. The power of the human soul or the spiritual being which tends toward a good or away from an evil recognized by the intellect. Okay, so take away from this real quick. The will is what's called a blind faculty or a blind power. The will chooses, but it has to be told what to choose. I remember back in the beginning when I said it sort of the will, in a way, sort of gets confused between the passions and the intellect. So the intellect could be saying something, but your body could be sort of saying something else. Right? I really, really, really want this thing. You know, we do it all the time with food, right? Like, I really shouldn't have this second piece of cake, but oh, it tastes so good, right? And we choose to take the cake. That's the idea, okay? So the will is a blind faculty. It has to be told what to do, what to choose. All right, so it is ordered to the good, but it has to be told what the specific good is from the, ideally from the intellect, right? And then, as I said earlier, then the passions help you do it with more intensity. All right, so the second half of this, I want to sort of fly through this part real quick, because we'll touch on it another time. A thing is said to be perfect insofar as it attains its proper end, which is the ultimate perfection thereof. Now it is charity that unites us to God, who is the last end of the human mind, since he that abideth in charity abideth in God and God in him. Therefore, the perfection of the Christian life consists radically in charity. All right, so you can ignore like everything except that last sentence for right now. So remember I said that the thing known is in the knower, right? And I said how we know God now, we know personally by faith. And St. Paul says what's going to happen to faith later on? Going to give way to vision. Know God as he truly is, right? That was the quote I had there. So we can't know God perfectly as he is in this life. Okay, we can only know him by faith. But we can love him as he is. So it's love that unites us to God, okay, most perfectly. So what does that mean concretely when I pray? It means that my prayer should mostly be acts of the will, okay? So I can sort of intellectually, I can sort of have a setting, I can think about, but our prayer always has to move us to make acts of the will, and this will make much more sense when I talk next week. But if acts of the will are just simple things, right? Like, I love you, God. If that's an act of the will. Help me. That's an act of the will. Right? You're willing to have God help you. That's not an intellectual concept. Those are just the simple ones, right? A resolution at the end of our prayer. So we God was moving us a certain direction, and we resolved from that point forward to change or amend ourselves in some way. Okay, so prayer is primarily about moving yourself to make meaningful acts of your will towards God. Okay, and we'll talk more about this next week when we talk about we begin to talk about prayer itself. So the point is that the only thing sort of that unites us to God is love, and so what we need to do is continue to grow in our love for God, continue to make acts of charity, and that actually unites us. Remember we talked last week about the Holy Spirit sort of making us make these acts of love, and then growing sanctifying grace because we made acts of love. All right, let's talk a little bit about, or a lot of it, or the rest of the time a bit, about the passions. All right, and you'll see why I'm going into detail in just a second. So there are two sets of passions. There are what are called the concupiscible passions. And passions is just sort of a word that theologians use to confuse people for emotions. Right? It's one of the specialist words. Concupiscible passions are ordered to a sensible good or evil simply as such. Right? So love is our primary emotion. Okay. That's why when people say love is not an emotion, they're not really being fully honest. Love is an emotion. It's also an act of the will. And in fact, the best acts of love are those that have both, right? That we actually love with our bodies and with our souls. Right? Because somebody who, you know, is volunteering and is totally withdrawn emotionally from me, I really don't want their love, right? So you can't just make an act of the will. You can't just will the good of another. You have to sort of have this sort of affective response to people too, to be fully human. So love is what sort of drives all of our emotions, right? Love as in that thing is a love for the good. That thing is a good, I want it. And then obviously it's an opposite of hate, right? That thing is an evil, I want to avoid. And once we identify the thing that we love, we either desire it, or if we identify the thing that we hate, we try to avoid it. So there's desire and aversion. And then the third set is when we actually get the thing, and then we have pleasure, or we didn't get the thing, we weren't unable to avoid it, and we experience sadness. All right, so those are the six emotions there, yes?
Could love be both concupiscible and irascible?
Sort of, that's a great question. As soon as I get to irascible, I'll explain it. And this will make sense all in a second. So the irascible is ordered to a sensible good or evil, when there's some sort of difficulty in attaining it. Okay. All right, so let's break this down real quick. So appetite just means something that we choose, right? So we have both a bodily appetite and an intellectual appetite. The intellectual appetite is the will. All right, so this is just sort of a simple inclination, right? I'm hungry, I see a steak, I love the steak, I move towards the steak, I desire it, and I get the steak and I have pleasure, okay? Kevin's about to take my steak. I realize he's closer than me. I hate Kevin.
Kevin will take your steak.
I experience sadness because he's still getting closer, he's faster and younger. And then he actually gets it and I'm completely, totally destroyed. all right, so that's the concupiscible appetites, okay? So love, we're attracted to the good as such. And actually, these should be flipped. Desire is sort of the second thing, so once we identify love, then we realize we could have that thing, we desire it. And then once we actually get the thing, we experience joy. All right, and then just the opposite, in the face of evil, we hate evil as such. We try to avoid the absent evil, and when we actually experience it, we experience sadness. All right, and then there's the irascible appetite or the irascible passions. So there is, first of all, there is hope. Okay, and again, this is the emotion of hope. This is when there's a good that's somehow hard to get to, but we hope, or we start moving towards the thing, that even though we don't have it yet, we have hope that we might get it. In the presence of an evil, we experience courage, something threatening. Despair, when we know we can't get the thing. Fear, when we know we can't avoid the thing. And then anger, when we experience the evil. And then to Keegan's question about the opposite of anger is also love. Okay, so in other words, once we attain the thing that we have, we experience joy or love of that thing. Okay. All right. So why did I do all this? So can we control our feelings? Brian says no. Anyone else say no?
It's possible.
I guess, like, you can't control your feelings now, but you can control them tomorrow by how you react to your feelings now.
All right. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. So that you just described. Go ahead and vote.
By control, do you mean, like, get rid of feelings? Or, like, just...
Sort of both. I left it very vague. So can... By that, what I mean is, can we use them? Or can we... Or are we going to completely and totally use to buy them?
So case,
we can use them?
Yeah, you mean, like, can you change your feelings, I guess?
Well, you can. Okay. So here's the idea. All right. So remember, go back to my chart about sort of the passion sort of running amok. So it used to be that all feelings and passions were completely controlled by the intellect and the will. So I had a will to feel something. And so there is what's called consequent. In other words, feelings that follow from a free decision, but because we're fallen, we also have what are called antecedent. So the emotion precedes the action of the will, so it just rises. Okay, somebody steps on my toe, immediately I get angry, not knowing anything. All right, but I have to sort of feed that in order to keep going. Should I be angry at them? So I evaluate. Were they just walking up and down the aisle stamping on feet, or was it just an accident? Let me ask you a question real quick. So we got a little bit of time before I go to the next couple slides. So this idea of being completely and totally able to control your emotions, what does that give you the... So when I said that Jesus could do that, does that mean Jesus felt more deeply than we do or less deeply?
More deeply.
Let me say more deeply. So when Jesus was sad, was he more sad than I can ever be? Yeah, think about that for a second. So in other words, when he willed to feel an emotion, so when he weeps at Lazarus' grave, he's more sad than we will ever be. Because he's able to, because the emotion, that's the proper emotion to feel at the death of a friend. And he was, because he wasn't, didn't have the effects of original sin, he was able to feel things more deeply. Okay? And the reason why I ask that is going to sort of, when you go into prayer, think about his sufferings in the garden. Okay, where he's running the full gamut of emotions. Because sometimes I think people will look at Jesus as like the stoic. He didn't really feel anything. Or you just go, well, he had complete control over his emotions. That means he just chose not to feel. But he was fully human and he chose to feel when he should feel how he felt, right? And so he felt happiness more than we could ever feel it. Yes?
Are emotions and feelings the same thing?
Yeah, more or less. In sort of common parlance, yeah, but not in the distinction. Like, that's why they use the word passion to separate them. But for the most part, I think when most people are saying feelings, I feel sad, I feel happy, I feel joy, I feel despair. All right, I'm going to come back to this instead and go to this last. This is sort of, we talked about this a little bit already. So here's where I want to sort of end, and it builds off of what I just said about the emotion. So how many of you heard about temperaments? Sort of know what a temperament is. Okay. How many of you have ever taken a personality test? Okay, so temperaments are basically like your personality test. Okay, so Myers-Briggs has, I think, like 16, different types of personalities or whatever. But classically, there's only been four. Okay. Which one am I? I'll let you know. I'm going to make you guys guess, actually. Yes.
So, like, I'm so confused. Like, so emotions are kind of like an input to us, more or less?
So yeah, that's, again, why the word passion is really good, because it has the connotation of passi in it, or passive. So there's something has to act on us to feel it.
So are we supposed to, like, just never listen to that? Are we supposed to interpret it, or?
I would say the virtuous person should listen to their feelings. right? The person who is prone to vice now. So it really matters whether your feelings are reliable, right? I mean, it's just the same as someone who suffers from like an anxiety disorder. Should they, when they feel anxious, should they really listen to it? Probably not, right? But somebody who, in the normal course of events, doesn't have an anxiety disorder and they feel a little bit uncomfortable, and they don't know why, you know, that might be a good idea to sort of check your surroundings, right? So, I mean, they're meant to be a form of knowledge. They're not bad. They're just, we're easily led astray by them.
The idea is just that, like, the intellect has to check the emotions
yes.
before they start affecting the will.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
So, sorry. Is the check of the emotions what we can control, or do we actually control what emotions we feel?
Both. So you check the emotion when it arises and says, "Is this a, go back to my example of stepping on my foot, right? Is it, should I be mad right here? Or should I feel anger?" And you go, "Oh, no, it's just this old lady with a cane, and it's not her fault," or whatever. And then if you continue with anger, then you sort of, you've now willed to be angry.
Control your emotions only over time, or?
Well, it's very difficult. If I have the habit of letting my anger go at the smallest thing, smallest provocation, I'm probably going to fly off the handle, right? And that's, yeah, it takes training because we're falling. All right, so I said there were, where was I? I must be just leaning on them, leaning on it. All right, so I said that personality tests, there's 16, but classically there's been 4. And the reason why there's been 4 is because there are 2 sets of passions with 2 types of emotions attached to them, okay? So remember what I said, personality, like this idea that our emotions affect us and affect the way we think about things, the way we perceive things. This is where the idea of a temperament comes in. And the reason why these are helpful is it helps us grow in self-knowledge, all right? So here are the questions, and then all this will make sense in this. So the 2 ways to sort of determine your temperament. Do I react immediately, and this is sort of naturally, okay? So what is my initial reaction? Do I react immediately or vehemently or slowly and superficially to a strong impression upon me? Does the excitement last for a long time or only for a short while? Okay. So immediate and long-lasting is what's called a choleric. Immediate and short-lasting is a sanguine. And we're going to talk about each of these so that I can sort of help you use them properly. Slowly and long-lasting is a melancholic. Slowly and short-lasting is a phlegmatic. Okay. So these are sort of our bodily reactions, the way we were made. Okay, so when you are a choleric, that is the way you were made. And it then begins to affect your soul. It kind of affects how you act. It also means that for someone like a choleric, for example, courage is really easy. Humility, not so much. Right, and we'll talk about each one of these in a second. But that's it. So sometimes we can delude ourselves and think, well, I'm pretty bold. When it's really just the fact that we're a choleric and we tend to get sort of stuck on principles and, you know, we'll do anything for the sake of a principle. All right, so let's talk about each one of these and then I'll sort of help you how to use them. All right, so a choleric, remember the choleric is the one who reacts immediately and sort of sticks to his guns, okay? Which just has then good side and bad side. The good side is they tend towards having zeal towards things. They tend to be sort of highly principled, right? These are the people that are on the irascible, and they're on the right-hand side of the irascible where they tend to feel anger, right? And so they tend to be a little bit more intelligent. And the reason being is that naturally when a person gets angry, they have to think before they react to something. They have to sort of assess the situation. So they're naturally sort of zealous. They're naturally a little bit more intelligent. Courage and fortitude come easily. And they tend to want to do great things. Okay? Tends to be most leaders or colleagues. Okay? And, of course, this has a dark side to it. And so they tend to be very sort of independent, very not very tolerant of people who react to things slower than they do. They tend to want to be in control. They tend to have sort of explosive anger. And then, obviously, pride becomes an issue. Okay. They tend to also be sort of imprudent. They act very quickly. Yes?
I thought you said that cholerics don't, like, humility is harder for them.
Yeah, humility is much harder because they have pride. So the virtues, no, those are the virtues you should work on if you're this. Okay. So the virtues they need are humility, meekness. Meekness is just unique of horse, right? So you take your anger and channel it in the correct way. It's a proper use of anger. Charity and compassion. They tend to be not very compassionate to other people at all. Because, again, they're very principle-based. They tend not to feel any emotions besides anger very deeply. And so they tend not to be very compassionate towards other people. So those four virtues. In their prayer life, meditating on the sufferings of both of Christ and their neighbor is important to be sort of develop that virtue of compassion, and then to sort of rely on the communion of saints. All right, let's talk about the sanguine. The sanguine person is the one who's quickly aroused and excited, but it doesn't last very long at all. And so they tend to be sort of happy. They tend to be very merciful because they easily sort of forget slights. Right? They tend not to hold on to things. They tend to be grateful and just tend to be friendly. And of course, the dark side of that is they tend towards envy. They love pleasure. Okay, so they're on the side of the concupiscible passions with joy and love. So they tend to be very, very sort of pleasure-driven, just by nature. Okay, so sort of understand this, that our bodies, some people, it's not hard to avoid food. Like, they just naturally, they're like, I don't feel that much pleasure from food. Other people, it's really hard, just from their bodily dispositions, right? And this is why it's really important for us to grow in our awareness of how we are, because we go, oh, you know what? For a choleric to mortification isn't all that hard, but for a sanguine, it's really hard. Okay, and I mean like bodily mortification in a choleric, but for a sanguine, it's really hard. And so that for them to grow, the goal is to keep the things on the light side and get rid of the things on the dark side. Okay. So they love pleasure. They tend towards vanity because they want to please other people. They want everybody to be happy. And they also, because their sort of response to things is not long-lasting, they tend to want to do something and then never follow through. And so they're very, very unstable. The virtues they need to work on are perseverance, chastity, and mortification. And for their prayer, they should meditate on the sufferings of Christ. I know, I just realized that.
Copy and paste it.
Sure. All right. So the melancholic. The melancholic is somebody who is, again, sort of feebly excited. It takes a lot to get them moving. Once they're moving, and they tend to hold on to it. Okay. Which means for these types of people, they tend to be a little more reflective. And so prayer always comes a little bit easier to them. But by the same token, they're sort of prone to inactivity. Okay? They're often sort of willing to suffer, especially long periods of time. They tend to be wise because they're more reflective. But again, because it takes so much to get them moving, they hardly ever commit to anything. So they're resolute, right? So the sanguine will commit to something and not follow through. But the melancholic has a lot of trouble sort of making a resolution. But when they do, they tend to stick to them. And they also have sort of the same issue of pride that the choleric has. But in their case, it's usually from a fear of failure. Okay. So their virtues they need to work on are zeal and humility. their prayer, they should really focus on meditating on things that are joyful, heaven, the lives of the saints. And then we have the phlegmatic. The phlegmatic is the one who is sort of doesn't respond very deeply or very quickly. So they tend to be sort of a little bit emotionally aloof. They tend to be meek. So in other words, it takes a lot to make them angry. They tend to be a little bit calmer. And because they're not as emotional or emotionally driven, they tend to sort of be good people to talk to. They're good listeners. And offering counsel because they don't get sort of emotionally involved. On the dark side, they obviously tend towards sloth and complacency. And they also have a sort of a problem with sensuality. So they tend to want to do things to distract themselves. So it's counterintuitive in some ways, but they want to sort of generate these emotions that they don't feel. Their virtues are constancy, zeal, and temperance. And the best way for them to pray, is what we'll talk about next week, is Lectio Divina, because it requires the sort of the sensing, the thinking, the feeling, and the intuition. So it's a very bodily way to pray. All right, so that is the four temperaments. And so how to use these? There are temperament tests online, and I would encourage you to go and take one. To me, these questions are usually good enough because you begin to see, well, oh, that makes sense as to why I act the way I do and why I feel the way I feel. And then you can sort of, that's a place to start in the spiritual life because these are your tendencies, right? And so you want to root out the things that you naturally, the sort of easy, low-hanging fruit of the things you naturally do. And then you sort of, and you'll notice that the light side of like a choleric, like if I hold on to those and I get rid of the dark side, suddenly I have picked up the light side of the sanguine, right? And so if I were to take all the light side of the sanguine as a choleric and work on those things, then I'd be sort of on my way toward perfection. And then when you do that, you're going to pick up some of the dark side of the sanguine, and then you sort of have, so it becomes a sort of a plan of life to look at these things. But it helps us, I think, understand our tendencies, because those are what you want to root out first. Yes, Nicole?
So can you change your, like, good?
Yeah, so your temperament should change. Like, that's the point, and to Keegan's question earlier, like, these are our sort of dispositions, the way we sort of naturally react to things. But we want to get where this is what virtue does, we move our souls to begin to move our bodies, not to respond that way. And so each time I mortify my anger, I become less and less choleric, for example.
So is it like one you want to be? Or
no, you want to be all of them. You want to be the light side of all of them. Christ was all these things.
Oh,
and not one of them. None of them, that's the thing. So none of them is better than another. Like, don't, like, I guess if you're, you know, if you're a sanguine, you'll envy other people's and envy
like
their temperaments.
Last year, Ben, like, you gotta collect all four.
Yeah, and it's not. And this is why I don't like the personality test, because they become like a thing. Like, well, I'm stuck at, you know, at this. This is a starting point, right, for us to sort of go to grow in self knowledge, to understand why we do the things we do, and understand, oh yeah, it has something to do with just the way my body responds. So, and it's also really, really helpful in dealing with other people, to be honest with you. Like, especially if you use it. I can identify when pretty much most people's temperament after talking to them for a little while. And I know how to move them, and I know how to motivate them, I know how to talk to them, right? I know, like, my choleric coworker, if I shame him, he's going to hate me forever. But if I flatter him in a certain way, in a good way, or if I keep going, what do you think? He's always going to go, I really like working with Ralph. and it's not for my own benefit, but for his benefit too, right? So, and especially it helps us, like when you have kids and you begin to learn their temperament, you learn what buttons to push to move them. And it's really good for your spouse too, to know their temperament. So there's a book, a really good book called The Temperament God Gave You. I have a copy of it if anyone wants to borrow it. But there's like three others, like the temperament that God gave your kids, the temperament God gave your spouse. But it's a really good way to sort of to even to understand how to interact with other people. So I would, like this week, spend a little bit of time. Just take one of the temperament tests and see where you fall. Yes?
I just wanted to reinforce what you were saying. So I was looking at this, like, I'm pretty sure that, like, the same week or, like, at this moment.
Yeah, I bet everyone in here that hasn't could already tell me what they are.
But then, like, right when you were showing the other stuff, I was thinking, like, wow, those other ones are way cooler. Like, that'd be really cool.
Yeah, it's always better to be somebody else, right? Oh, so Sharby left, so you guys don't get to guess what mine is.
Wait, what?
Sharby asked if he could guess what mine was. If you want to guess. Alright, I'll let it be. So how many people think I'm choleric? 1, 2, 3, 4. How many people think I'm sanguine? How many people think I'm melancholic? Wow. How many people think I'm phlegmatic? Well, you guys didn't vote. That's lame. Come on, put yourself out there.
We voted for one of them.
Yeah. I mean, I guess choleric wins. I am a choleric. 100% like choleric.
It also helps our guessing that you kept saying I when you were talking about
it. Oh, did I really? Little Freudian slip. yes. So, again, this is not like you have to identify yourself. Like, if you see two there, you can have, like, a secondary temperament. The purpose of this, remember, is to begin to work, right? So you're like, okay, now I know that bodily, that's just the way I respond, right? And that I need to work on the virtues to bring those under control. All right, is this helpful? That's the whole thing we're going to do this, I mean... If you don't grow in self-knowledge from what we're talking about, I've made it way too abstract. So this is a concrete way. So again, if anybody wants that book, I will bring it next week. Just let me know if you want me to bring it. I also think I have there's also one online called The Temperaments and the Spiritual Life that I can send you a link to. And they're short. The one online is like 40 pages. But at least read the one you think you are. It's helpful. All right, other questions, comments? Yes?
You could just post that link on Facebook.
Yeah, I will. Well, I will. Somebody will.
I mean, is it like, I almost want to say, is it possible to sort of like work on the wrong ones and like kind of overdo it or not be strategic?
Well, I don't know that you can work on that. I mean, think about what's predominant. Ask the people who are closest to you what they think. and she or they may be able to tell you, hey, I think you're on the right track. Because I guarantee you, like, seriously, like, I wouldn't have to go home and tell my wife I'm choleric. She would go, no duh. So it's a lot of those things is more obvious to the people around us than it is to us, unfortunately. All right, other questions? All right, so next week we will dive into prayer. We'll talk about the level of prayers and sort of parallel that with the level growth in the spiritual life, so the three stages of the spiritual life. And then I think the following week is Super Bowl Sunday, so then we'll go into Lent after that. All right, who wants to pray? Go for it.
In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Lord, I thank you for this time to just kind of learn more about our faith, learn more about ourselves. Lord, and I pray that you grant us the grace of the Holy Spirit to know ourselves better and to be able to use that knowledge to your greater glory. Amen. Amen. Amen.